Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, historian Monty Real tells us how the Western world discovered gorillas.
They tell stories of how it abducts women in the forest, and it just is painted as this monster.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. Ada Calhoun revisits the great and unusual baseball career of Met star Mike Piazza.
And his father made him a batting cage in the backyard, or in the garage. So he had this kind of immense setup, and he would just hit balls all day.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Well, believe it or not, even at this late age, there are disputes and debates about where human creatures fit into nature's universe or God's universe. There's an important new book out. It's called Between Man and Beast: An Unlikely Explorer, the Evolution Debates, and the African Adventure That Took the Victorian World by Storm. It's by Monty Real, and it's reviewed on our cover by David Quammen, who says, Real's book is filled with storylines, celebrity walk-ons, vivid eccentrics, and it rattles along with fine, wacky momentum. I'm delighted that Monty is joining us from Evanston, I believe. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
Okay. So we have at the center of this story a remarkable and somewhat enigmatic figure who kind of introduced this extraordinary phenomenon of gorillas to the Western world.
Yeah. His name is Paul Du Chaillu. And in the mid-19th century, as you said, he was really the person who did more than anyone else to introduce the world to gorillas, which at that time was this new sort of unknown species. Du Chaillu moved to Africa to join his father, who was a French trader, in 1848. And just by chance, just a year or so before that, an American missionary had discovered and collected the first gorilla skull known to science. And at that time, it wasn't called a gorilla. The native hunters called it an ingina. And so Wilson had this skull. It eventually made its way to Harvard in the United States, was given the name gorilla, classified. Du Chaillu, meanwhile, over in Africa, moved in with Wilson. He sort of was adopted into their household.
And Wilson was the man who discovered the first skull?
He was the American missionary who discovered the first skull. So Du Chaillu became a part of his household. And so he's hearing these stories, kind of these legends from native hunters about this animal, and they basically say that it's this almost mythical creature that has supernatural strength. They tell stories of how it abducts women in the forest, and it just is painted as this monster. Well, a few years later, when he's in his 20s, Du Chaillu decides to launch an expedition to try to become the first person to encounter gorillas in the wild and describe them. So he goes in essentially into the interior of Africa in Gabon in 1856. And when he emerges in 1859, after just years of incredible adventure in there, he comes out with more than 20 gorilla skins, which he stuffs. And this is the exact moment that Charles Darwin, of course, publishes On the Origin of Species. So at the exact time you have people debating really seriously this idea that men and apes might have some sort of kinship, this new ape bursts onto the scene and causes a sensation that Du Chaillu is in the middle of. He just kind of stumbles into these enormous debates about man's place in nature.
And Monty, you make me realize that, if you watch Inherit the Wind, or, you know, you revisit the debates about evolution, the line that of denigration one always heard was that they're saying men are the same as apes or descend from apes. And now I realize that was the piece that kind of prompted that, the piece of the story. When he got those 20 skins, does that mean he killed those gorillas?
Yeah, he was essentially a hunter, and his expedition was a real kind of seat-of-the-pants adventure. He didn't have any scientific training when he went in there to speak of. He tried to kind of to maintain scientific standards, but he hadn't been trained. He was essentially a hunter. He traveled with a very small party of porters and guides. They were essentially people from tribes that he would meet as he traveled along. If you compare his expedition, for example, with other expeditions of that day, using Henry Morton Stanley as an example, when Stanley went to look for Livingston in his famous expedition into the other side of Africa, into East Africa, Stanley had like 11,000 pounds of equipment by his own estimation. Du Chaillu went in with all his equipment and all the men who accompanied him in one single dugout canoe. So he was essentially kind of a do-it-yourself explorer. He was trying to collect specimens and send them back to the Philadelphia Academy of Natural Science. He had had a sort of gentleman's agreement with members of the academy that he would hunt and stuff specimens and send them back to the academy for display. And so that's essentially what he did. He would spend his days hunting in the forest with native hunting companions and spend his evenings doing taxidermy outside of his tents. Eventually, he encountered bands of gorillas and was able to collect more than 20 of those.
Now, when he came back to the West and presented all of this, what was the reaction? I ask this because our reviewer, David Quammen, who, as you know, is a superb science writer himself, says that one of the great aspects of the narrative you tell is how audiences received this fantastic and marvelous sort of mind-stretching news or information. He says, in fact, how credulous they were about the stories they were hearing about gorillas.
It kind of happened in two waves with Du Chaillu. His first stop when he came out of the forest, he went to New York first, and he went to Broadway and sort of amazingly opened up this showroom right on Broadway to display his specimens. But his timing was awful. The Civil War was just starting to bubble up. New York was a city that was really distracted. But even more so, P.T. Barnum had his own showroom or museum just down the street on Broadway. And Barnum tried to upstage Du Chaillu by saying he not only had a quote-unquote man-monkey, but his was alive. It was a hoax, of course. He essentially put a man in a monkey suit. But it did, take away some of Du Chaillu's thunder there. But he went to London right after that, and that's where this blew up into a sensation. London was absolutely transfixed by these gorillas. And Du Chaillu would give lectures, and he himself was something of a showman. He really got into the stories. He would talk about how when he first saw the gorillas, they would charge, and he used a lot of body language to kind of convey what a almost monster this gorilla seemed to him when it was coming at him. So he was painting this kind of, this picture of the gorilla as this absolute monster, and audiences just ate it up. Scientists, meanwhile, were saying this was the animal that was man's closest relative in the animal kingdom. So it had this kind of power to inspire all these passions and fears in people. And Du Chaillu really kind of exploited that a little bit. He told the stories for all they were worth.
And what became of him in the end? How did his life and career round out?
Well, right after that, the gorillas really became the sensation. He was attacked, first by scientists who said that he was untrained, and he was. He had made mistakes in his descriptions and his maps. He didn't really know how to make maps at that time. So he was disparaged on a scientific level and then also on a more personal level. People questioned his background. And he was driven actually to challenge his critics to accompany him on another expedition to prove that he had actually gone where he said he'd gone and seen the things that he'd said he'd seen. because his credibility was really being ravaged at that time. So he ended up taking a second expedition to try to kind of confirm the things that he had said in the first. And his life took on kind of an unusual arc. He never, after that second expedition, went back to Africa. Instead, he became kind of a storyteller. He wrote books for children and also books for adults that were on subjects like Norse mythology or travels into different areas of the world besides Africa. And he ended up dying in 1903 in Russia on a trip that he was taking there, hoping to write another book that sort of mixed anthropology and ethnography and myth. He was always interested in the stories that people told about the places that they lived.
Well, it's a fascinating life and a fascinating book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Monty Real, whose new book, Between Man and Beast, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is the Neil Gaiman Presents production of Dimension of Miracles, written by Robert Sheckley and read by Jonathan Hodgman. That's Dimension of Miracles, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Leslie Kaufman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Leslie.
Hello, Sam.
So are we looking at a solution to one of the longstanding problems in journalism, which is how in the digital age do long-form writers continue to be productive and get their work out to readers?
People are very excited about long-form. For the first time in as long as I can remember really being a journalist, I broke into journalism in the 90s, and long form was already in decline. The heyday of long form, the fabulous Esquire articles, the fabulous New Yorker articles were already shrinking. There just wasn't space.
Now, Leslie, let's very quickly walk our listeners through what we mean by long form journalism. We don't mean like a page one story in the New York Times.
No, we don't.
A profile of maybe 3,000 or 4,000 words or three or four pages in the New Yorker. We're talking about a kind of narrative. Is that right?
Right. You're talking about a narrative, and we're talking about something that goes into depth. So it's this weird form that falls between book and modern magazine. And the numbers they put on it is 5,000 words to 30,000 words, anywhere in there. But you think of it as 50 pages.
50 pages of like a manuscript, let's say.
Yeah, 50 pages of a manuscript. And it gives you a chance to really get in and know an issue without having to actually invest book-length attention.
So now the web has found a way, or the digital universe has found a way, to support this kind of writing. Is that right?
It is the fastest growing, and people are tremendously excited about it. And what's interesting is the readers here seem to be looking for short books. So it fits into the time of short attention spans. So we are getting book readers that are buying this long-form journalism or short fiction, and it's become something that is exciting to people. It's being sold digitally. Penguin has reinvented what used to be its short form books and is very behind those. They use them now as the marketing platform as part of a marketing plan for longer books. And then there are these websites that are devoted to long form journalism that are developing audiences. So there's a lot of excitement about this area.
Leslie, give us some of the names of the successful websites or the pioneers here and some of the players, some of the writers who are really succeeding in this format.
Sure. So the big one out there, and it's a slash store publisher, so it's very unique, is Amazon Kindle Singles. And they both promote original fiction and journalism, and also pick their own. They publish about 2 a week of these long-form pieces, and they promote them on their website, and they have gotten some success. The biggest one is already a best-selling author, Lee Childs, who produces a short story related to an upcoming book before he has a book as a way of promotion. He sold 250,000 copies through
Amazon. So these are 250,000 copies of a Kindle single, in effect.
Exactly.
Now, Leslie, there was also a fair amount of attention. I think you discussed this with us when John Krakauer wrote what was in effect an ebook that exposed the Three Cups of Tea story.
Three Cups of Deceit.
Yes, and that was also done in this long form digital arena. Is that right?
Right. That was done through another place. It was a big breakout hit for something called Byliner.com. And Byliner has some very big authors like Amy Tan. They tend to focus on big authors, and they're just a publisher. Now, they're developing an app where you can buy directly from them, but they're more in the traditional form of a publisher. They're screening out material. They're publishing top-notch stuff, and it's digital, mostly digital.
And it's interesting because I think the founder, or certainly one of them, of Byliner, Mark Bryant,
exactly,
is a brilliant magazine editor who was at the Times for a while. And so he's taken that. Some of our listeners will be familiar with the very famous essay by David Foster Wallace on Roger Federer that appeared in Play, the Times's sport magazine when we had one, that Mark Bryant was responsible for. So he's taken that. He took that idea and moved it onto the web as well.
Well, I think I love that you're pointing out that it's Mark Bryant, because what's so interesting to me about this particular space, which has been one of the most successful digital spaces, is that it is dominated by old form, long form people. Mm. David Blum, the editor of Amazon Kindle Singles, is an old long form guy, worked for New York Magazine, worked for our magazine here, wrote a piece on Julia Ormond, who's the actress. He wrote a piece on Chef David Boulay. So he's been around a million years, was an editor of The Village Voice, was an editor of the New York Press. So these are old form guys who used to work at Esquire, at New York Magazine, and Outside Magazine. These are masters of the old form who are transitioning into the new form, and they know how to do it.
Well, that is really heartening, because as someone who comes out of that older world of print journalism, young though I sound.
look, Sam.
One of the great attributes in editors like David Blum or Mark Bryant that one comes to value and appreciate so much is their just sheer editorial skill. You write something of considerable length and there's good stuff in it, but you don't know quite how to make it narrative or turn it into a story. You don't know what needs to be added and, more important, what needs to come out, and they're really good at that. So for those skills to be translated to the web really answers one of those nagging questions we all had.
Right, and I think there are two other exciting things about it. One, there seems to be a real audience for that. You know, it's sort of funny to me after being around. It turns out the people don't want all short. So it's exciting to know there is an audience out there. And the other thing is David has been able to use this forum to bring along young journalists to help discover people and mold young people at the long form length. And there didn't used to be a place for those people to go. So that's exciting too.
Yeah, that seems to be one of the most important great pieces of news for the literary culture, that those skills are being translated to the web. And we know newer journalists are coming through the web, so they get the experience of being edited by real maestros.
And fiction writers. So I think our future novelists and future long-form biographers and nonfiction writers are being developed right now through these long forms and will be showcased and brought along through these forms.
Well, Leslie, we'll be looking for your first web-based
long-form. That's right. Keep your eye out.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Baseball is back, and the Mets actually won a game. There's a new book. It's called Long Shot by, yes, Mike Piazza with Lonnie Wheeler. It's reviewed for us by a great sports fan, among her many other talents, Ada Calhoun. Here's here to talk about it. Welcome, Ada.
Thank you, Sam.
Comment first. Lonnie Wheeler is actually a very good sports writer,
yes,
and ghost writer. I think he did Henry Aaron's book, or did a book about Henry Aaron.
I think he's done several, yeah.
Yeah, and how's this one? Is this one pretty good?
I think it's pretty good. Yeah, I think it's quite good. It's very funny in a lot of places.
And is it Piazza himself who's funny, or is it just a pretty good writer who's making him sound funny?
You get a sense of his voice, I think, of him being actually pretty self-deprecating in certain places. I mean, it's interesting because in other places he has this huge ego, but one joke he makes is, you know, the reason that he was catching was because the scouts had seen him play first base.
and they knew he couldn't do it. Okay, now let's walk through Piazza's career, because it actually is an extraordinary one.
It is.
At one point, for several years, he was one of the greatest players ever in his position, right?
Indeed.
He was a monster hitter.
Yes.
But he's not someone that was really predicted for. So tell us who he was and where he was from and how it happened.
He was from around Philadelphia, and his dad was friends with Tommy Lasorda, and his father really wanted him to be a ball player and set up
And Lasorda, the great manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he had kind of an in that way. And his father made him a batting cage in the backyard or in the garage. So he had this kind of immense setup, and he would just hit balls all day.
Okay, so that's interesting. So he's one of these great players molded by dad.
And
we've heard that before. Mantle was another.
Right.
But Piazza was into this. I mean, he wanted to be a ball player.
He wanted to be a ball player, and he was obsessed with players. He was a ball boy. At one point.
For the Phillies in Philadelphia?
For the Phillies, yeah. And, Tommy Lasorda gave him, the cool Dodgers jacket, him and his brother. And he's actually his brother's godfather, Tommy Lasorda.
So he grew up, he played high school ball there in Philadelphia?
Yeah, he played high school, and he really thought he was amazing, and he was, it sounds like. And then
he
thought he was amazing. He was just, he worked really hard. That was kind of all he did, it sounds like, was just hit balls nonstop. And then, of course, he gets to, college ball, and he actually hasn't really had a glove on his hand very much because he's been training as a power hitter. So then, of course, he gets there, and his fielding is not so good.
But he was still, not a giant talent. He wasn't like a Mantle or a Mays, somebody they'd look at and see phenom written all over him,
no,
right?
No, and he couldn't really throw people out. I mean, that was a problem he had even, into his really successful major league career. Throwing people out at second base was not something he was really
right, I think his thing on the Mets was to try to kind of reason with them and talk them back to first base. Okay, but was he drafted well, or was he kind of in the middle of the pack or even low?
He was way, way, way down on the list. And he was actually what's called a courtesy draft pick, which I had never really heard. I had never heard that term before this book. And it basically meant that it was a favor to Tommy Lasorda.
By the Dodgers and Lasorda. So he enters their system.
He does.
So now he's in their farm system.
Right.
And where was the Dodgers' farm system? Where did he play first, does he say?
He played all over. And that's some of the really fun stuff in the book is his playing in, the Mexican Winter Leagues and in the minor league system and just really having these incredible ups and downs. And there's one point where the townspeople are, throwing baseballs at the bus as they're, driving away. There was a lot of drama, it sounds like.
So they bring him up,
yes.
And he does have some, he is a really good hitter. They
he's
begin to see
an
this.
He's amazing hitter. Yes.
Even at this early stage.
Even at this early stage, he's doing really well hitting. But again, he is slow. He's not throwing people out. They're trying him at first base where he's terrible.
And what's the problem at first base? He doesn't have the agility to move it.
He's just a bad fielder. He's real slow. And actually, one of the good jokes that he has in here is that his solution to being such a terrible base runner was just to hit the ball out of the park.
So then they bring him up. He gets to the show or whatever they call it.
Gets to the show.
And how long did it take him to establish himself as a really good player, a really good hitter?
It was a little bit stop and start. He definitely had slumps, and he sort of tells the story of getting into kind of a bad place and then coming back. And the whole time, he just is really determined. I mean, one thing that comes across is that he knows he's great and can be better, and he works so hard.
And what does he talk about his teammates much? I mean, is he a guy who was sort of fun in the clubhouse?
Fun in the clubhouse. No. It's funny because he has friends. He has, a best friend who he rooms with. And he's got, a buddy. And he definitely is a very eligible bachelor. And he goes out and he dates actresses.
Yeah.
Not right now.
Yeah,
now he's married.
Right.
But at
right.
the time, so he's this sort of hotshot player. And
He's in L.A., too.
He's dating the actresses. He's having a good time. But he wasn't a team leader. And one of the things I found most interesting about the book was just talking about all the pressure he felt to be a leader. Just that he didn't have it in him. He was more of a see the ball, hit the ball kind of guy.
Well, that's interesting. Does he then say what the qualities are a leader needs that he didn't have? I mean, are you supposed to be more talkative, more supportive of other players? Does he get into that at all?
He does.
Or just say it wasn't me?
No, I mean, he does a little bit. He talks about just, that he felt this pressure to, be a mentor and be inspiring and be more friendly, and he was a real hothead. He liked having fights. He doesn't regret fights that he had. I think a lot of memoirs tend to say, you know, oh, and I really let myself get carried away. He actually regrets not having fought Roger Clemens.
So now we come to the great incident. I mean, our headline is called Roger and Me. So we'll do one more step here. And by the way, what is becoming the epic chronicle of Mike Piazza. Okay. So he got traded to the Mets.
Yes. Or
was that a trade? I can't remember
big,
now.
And he's actually still, it sounds like, very bitter that the Dodgers let him go. He really felt like they should have stepped up and offered him more money. He was a huge, huge, phenomenal hitter by this point.
Oh, he was
really
a giant star
of his game. And, you know, it really came down to, I think they felt like he was, you know, asking for too much. And he felt like, you know, how dare they nickel and dime me after all I've done.
So Piazza then came to the Mets, and he was supposed to be the savior, right?
And yes, he was. And in a way, I mean, he did his job. And that's one thing that's kind of interesting about the book, too, is just, again, the failure to actually lead in this really substantial way. Like, on one hand, you have to say, yeah, he's like, I'm hitting all these home runs. What more do you want from me? But I think at the same time, we wanted a little bit more. We wanted, because he was so amazing, I think there was this sense that he should not only be the savior as far as hits, but also be like a Keith Hernandez kind of guy in the clubhouse to really just make everybody feel better.
And his team, the team that he was the best player on, made it to the World Series.
Yes.
And played the Yankees.
Right.
Which is an extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
And then came this bizarro incident.
Very strange.
And tell us about it.
Well, I think it was July that Roger Clemens threw a fastball at his head. So he was up to bat, and he had, like, I think it was like he was 7-for-10 or something against Clemens. And then so he gets this beanball and, like, gets a minor concussion. And he really says it had to have been deliberate. And, of course, Roger Clemens says it wasn't, but he said, no, he had really good control. It was definitely on purpose.
And Clemens is at least as aggressive.
Yes.
Self-aggrandizing,
yes.
As I mean, you put three Piazzas together and you don't get Clemens, right?
It's true.
Clemens is also a big, studly guy.
Very
and Piazza's
alpha.
The, yes.
Yes, they both are total alpha males, totally jacked up. Like, yes, no, this was kind of going to happen.
This is not like James Joyce and Proust in
it
the back of the taxi in Paris.
Indeed,
there's
not.
A whole different thing going on here.
Exactly.
So then there's the famous incident.
Okay. So that's in July, and that sets the stage where he really, you know, this hatred is brewing, and he tells the press, Roger Clemens threw up my head on purpose. And then Roger Clemens comes and says he didn't, and it just kind of like escalates in the press. So then they meet again at the World Series, and he gets like jammed on this inside fastball, and the bat splinters into three pieces, and one of them goes flying at Clemens. So Piazza's running to first, carrying one of the other pieces, and then suddenly Roger Clemens takes the shard that's hit him and or come to the mound and throws it at the feet of Piazza, who's running. So then Piazza charges the mound and is like, what's going on? And although in more colorful language, and then it sort of gets weirdly diffused because Roger Clemens said, I thought it was the ball. Which confuses Piazza long enough for him to not throw a punch, and then the whole thing's over, and he regrets forever never having actually decked the guy.
Is there also this kind of subtextual thing that was the statement maybe the Mets needed? That's the kind of leader we wanted?
Yes. I think everybody wanted that fight. And you know, I think Mets fans, any chance to get the Yankees is really appealing to us. And I think the fact that he just kind of walked away was disappointing to him and to other people.
And then later, of course, came all the revelations about Clemens.
Sure.
And speculation. Does Piazza address it? That maybe Clemens was kind of jacked up in a different way when
yes.
he had this outburst. What does he say about that?
He talks a lot about steroids in the book. And I mean, I think the timing is not a coincidence that he was up for the Hall of Fame right around the time the book is coming out. And he didn't get in this year.
Was it close?
It was pretty close. Nobody got in. What was it? He fell 98 votes short of the 75% required.
This was his first year of eligibility?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And he didn't quite make it.
He didn't quite make it. And I think the reason people assume that he didn't make it is because there is the suspicion that he used steroids.
The steroids question surfaces and it touches Piazza himself.
That's right.
Piazza obviously wants to mount some kind of defense here. We know he's not the best defensive player. We're not really a defensive specialist. How does he do here with the steroid charges?
First of all, he says that he doesn't judge anybody who did do them. He's very careful to just to say that he doesn't think that it's really necessarily the worst thing in the entire world to use steroids in general. And he says there's a real drug culture in sports, that they play so many games a year in baseball, and that he felt like a pinata a lot of times, and that basically the trainers would load them up with all kinds of things. And the boundary for him between all of that and then these illegal things, and where when you cross that line, just I think for him it seemed a little fuzzy.
And so does he then definitively state, I did not use, you know, HGH, the human growth hormone or steroids or this whole category of drugs, that he did not use them?
He says he never used anything illegal. He says he did use what's called Andro, which I think was later banned, but that he never used anything illegal while it was illegal.
And what – and you said the – jury is still kind of out on him. He didn't get into the Hall of Fame. I mean, he had – did he have the career, Ada, to justify it normally?
Certainly, yes.
So he hit lots of home runs.
Tons of
very
home
high
runs.
Batting average for a period, too.
Phenomenally high batting average. And, you know, he does point out, too, in this rather lengthy defense of his fielding and his catching, that the pitchers that he caught had a really low ERA.
So that means very few runs scored. So he's doing a good job calling the pitches, calling the game, getting batters out.
Yes, it appears that he was definitely much better at calling games and communicating with pitchers than he was at, say, throwing people out.
So he's not involved in the game now. He's not a coach. He's not a manager. I mean,
no,
at the major league
he's
level.
He's not. He's not.
Okay. Well, it's you know, it's one of those kind of great careers that can easily get overlooked. Do you think that he's made the case for himself as somebody people will really want to know about? If you were a member of the whatever they are, National Sports Writers Association, mm-hmm. would you vote for Mike Piazza?
I would vote for Mike Piazza just based on the September 11th home run, which was one of the very few purely cathartic moments in Mets history.
Thanks so much, Ada.
Thank you.
That's Ada Calhoun, who reviews Long Shot by Mike Piazza and Lonnie Wheeler in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
So give us the new stuff.
On the fiction hardcover list this week, there are a few new books, starting at number 10. Therese Ann Fowler's novel Z, which is sort of an imagined version of Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald's turbulent marriage, that hits the list at number 10. It's her fourth novel, but just her first time on the list. And this kind of trend of jazz age literary couples has been very big lately. You may remember Paula McLean's novel, The Paris Wife, which is about Ernest Hemingway's first wife.
Well, and also kind of tangentially related, or maybe more directly, Woody Allen's film, Midnight in Paris, is also kind of jazz age, lost generations, very romantic period.
Yeah, we can't get enough of the gossip, the personalities of this time. And so that book continues in that vein. At number 7, Donna Leon, who's a regular on this list for her mysteries set in Venice, is new at number 7 with another in her series of mysteries set in Venice called The Golden Egg. Then at number 4, another regular mystery series writer, Jacqueline Winspear, who also writes historical novels. These are set after World War I, between the world wars, featuring a private investigator, Maisie Dobbs, and a psychologist. This is the newest book in that series called Leaving Everything Most Loved, new at number 4. At number 3, the Pulitzer-winning novelist Elizabeth Strout, she won the Pulitzer for her last novel, Olive Kitteridge, is new on the list with a book called The Burgess Boys. My wife was interested in reading Olive Kitteridge, and she just, every time that she picked it up, she ended up putting it down and saying, it just sounds too much like an American Girl's doll. And the Burgess Boys has some of that same feel in its title. There's this kind of all-American nostalgic sound to it, the Burgess Boys. But it is a book that really goes deep into personal lives, looking at a couple of brothers from small town Maine who've become lawyers now in New York City, and their sister. And the sister's son has just been arrested for a hate crime up in the town in Maine where they all grew up, for rolling a frozen pig's head into a storefront mosque run by some Somali immigrants up in this town.
That sounds like an American Girl story. I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell you and your wife something right here and now. Jocelyn, are we recording this? And not to be self-righteous and pompous, or rather to be self-righteous and pompous, because those are the only things I know how to be. For every upper middle class, hyper-educated, elite couple living on or near the Connecticut shore and taking that expensive commuter train into Manhattan every day so you can work in the flashy New York Times building, there are at least like four people out there who say, wow, it reads like an American Girl's novel. I think I'll keep going.
I don't mean anything against the American Girl's books, which in fact we read to our daughter every night. I'm just saying Elizabeth Strout might work on her titles a little bit.
Ooh,
the story's fantastic, compelling, interesting stories, and obviously with a wide audience. It's just the titles, you know, this sounds a little bit like the Hardy Boys.
Vent.
Not venting, just new at number one.
Yes.
The paranormal romance writer J.R. Ward has a new book, book 11 of her Black Dagger Brotherhood series, Lover at Last, enters the list at number one.
Okay, so I told you, I think you've heard this, Greg, and also Jocelyn, what my plan is, if and when I ever finish the biography of William F. Buckley Jr. I'm writing and it's published, I want it to be called William F. Buckley, 11th in the series.
I thought you were going to say William F. Buckley, A Paranormal Romance.
What about nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side, new at number 14, Denise Kiernan, a journalist, has a book called The Girls of Atomic City. Really an interesting story. This it's a look at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, a town that didn't exist before World War II. But by mid-1945, there were 75,000 residents. It was using more electricity than New York City. And the reason is that the government established Oak Ridge as the site of its top secret uranium enrichment for the Manhattan Project. And it brought in young women mostly, along with some soldiers, some army workers, but mostly young women, nurses and, high school students to put them to work enriching uranium. Didn't tell them what they were doing, and most of them didn't figure out what they were doing until the bomb fell on Hiroshima.
So they were just going into laboratories or factories and doing some kind of discrete, narrow task without realizing it was part of this extraordinary operation.
If any of them started to piece it together to ask questions, they were dismissed. It was, you have to remember a time of loose lips sink ships and keep it under your hat and this kind of tremendous secrecy. And so they were really looking for kind of compliant, just do as you're told types who would come in, do their job, go home. They're settling a small town, and in the off hours, these people really had nothing to do. And so they started arranging dances for them 5 nights a week and kind of trying to create a social scene. And it worked. You had all these young single women and these young soldiers, and a lot of them ended up dating and marrying and starting families. And Oak Ridge is still a flourishing town today.
And what else?
Finally, new at number 10 on the nonfiction list, another interesting subject, although a much more visited subject, also set around World War II, the book Those Angry Days by the popular historian Lynn Olson, who specializes in World War II histories. She's previously written about Churchill's rise in England and about American citizens in London.
Right. She's particularly interested in the Anglo-American connection.
She is, although this book is specifically about FDR and Charles Lindbergh in the years leading up to World War II.
Although I have to say I read this book because I was at one point thinking I might write about it, and then in the end we made a different decision. And we will be reviewing it. But she's actually in this one, too. She's really good on British statesmen in the United States, for instance.
Well, because there was a lot of lobbying to get America involved in the war, and then there was this very rabid strain of isolationism represented by Charles Lindbergh, and isolationism and appeasement. It was kind of, how much of a threat does Hitler represent? Is it our responsibility to get involved in this war? And FDR said yes, Lindbergh said no, and they represented kind of the leaders of these separate strands of thought. And she's very good on going into the politics of that.
And one other thing to add that's so interesting about that book is here we are at a moment when many are looking back 10 years later to the beginnings of the Iraq war, the Iraq invasion. And one of the themes that surfaces repeatedly, left and right, on the left and the right, is that there was not really a debate about it. One of the impressive things Lynn Olson does is to make you see that there really was a debate back then, a multivocal debate. Journalists, historians, citizens. Franklin Roosevelt had the Secretary of War he appointed, Henry Stimson, make a speech in defense of intervention rather than doing it himself. That's almost
like
inconceivable
Colin
today.
Speech
today. Exactly right. Yes, where you choose an important figure, and Powell did it in front of the United Nations, and of course later regretted it. Stimson did it as a radio address to the nation.
And Marshall did not. It's interesting that the original Marshall plan then was, hey, let's just stay out of it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. No, it's an interesting history and a real reminder of how deep-seated and long-standing two different ideas, two conflicting ideas of American exceptionalism are. One is that any engagement with the outside world will taint us and weaken our democracy. The other conflicting one is we are the great arsenal of democracy, in Roosevelt's phrase, so we need to spread it to the rest of the world, and that debate will never end. You know what? I think my soapbox needs a couple feet added to it, Jocelyn. Not just because I'm short, because the people in the very back row need to hear that projecting voice. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.